bless you and ask that you be with us. Amen. Very good. So this portion, Leviticus chapters 9 through 11, is called Shemini, which is the Hebrew word for eighth. And it, of course, comes from verse 1 of chapter 9. On the eighth day, Moses summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. So the portion is referred to as the eighth from the word Shemini in the first verse. He said to Aaron, take a bull calf for your sin offering and a ram for your burnt offering, both without defect, and present them before the Lord. Then say to the Israelites, take a male goat for a sin offering, a calf and a lamb, both a year old without defect, for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for a fellowship offering, to sacrifice before the Lord, together with a grain offering mixed with olive oil. For today the Lord will appear to you. They took the things Moses commanded to the front of the tent of meeting, and the entire assembly came near and stood before the Lord. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded you to do, so that the glory of the Lord may appear to you. Moses said to Aaron, come to the altar and sacrifice your sin offering and your burnt offering, and notice, make atonement for yourself and the people. Sacrifice the offering that is for the people and make atonement for them as the Lord commanded them. Okay? So, we'll talk about this most of the time and get to something towards the end if we can. This expression on the eighth day, as I mentioned, the Hebrew word is Shemini. It means the eighth. It describes the events of the day on which the Mishkan, the portable sanctuary built by the people of Israel in the Sinai Desert, was inaugurated. It was the eighth day because it followed a seven-day training period. Now, this is still, I was going to say an awkward expression, because since the week involves a seven-day cycle, you would think that the day after the seventh-day cycle would be connected to the new cycle, that it would be called the first day of the new cycle, right? But it's not. It's called the eighth day, which connects it to the seven-day cycle. So, this is one of those expressions in Hebrew that is awkward and intended to have the effect of focusing our attention on it. What is special about the eighth? Okay? Because there is certainly something special about the eighth, about the expression, about the fact that the word eighth is connected to the current seven-day cycle, as if it doesn't really end like it's supposed to, rather than like tonight, for example. This is Shabbat. Tonight, when there are three stars in the evening sky, Shabbat will end, and we do Havdalah. Right? It's a service that separates Shabbat from the beginning of a new week. And the prayers we recite and the things we say all emphasize the fact that one week ends and another week begins. But with the word eighth, that is not the case, right? The one week transitions, but it doesn't really end in the way that weeks do and new weeks begin. At any rate, it was the eighth day because it followed a seven-day training period during which the Mishkan was erected each morning and disassembled each evening, and Aaron and his four sons were initiated into the Kehuna, into the priesthood. But it was also a day which our sages described as possessing many firsts. It was a Sunday, the first day of the week. It was the first of Nisan, marking the beginning of the new festival year, There are several new years in the Jewish calendar, but the first of Nisan is the first month of the holiday cycle, or the festival cycle. It was the first day that the divine presence came to dwell in the sanctuary. It was the first day of the kehuna, the priesthood, when they actually began their service to the Lord. It was the first day of the service in the sanctuary, and there are others as well. With so many firsts associated with this day, why does the Torah refer to it, and by extension to the entire parsha, as the eighth day, right? Why doesn't the text say, on the first day of the new week, Moses summoned Aaron and his sons? That's what it should say, but it doesn't. And when it doesn't, something is going on that we're supposed to pay attention to. Okay? The cycle. The number seven figures prominently in our reckoning and experience of time. Most familiar is the seven-day work, a rest cycle that comprises our week, in reenactment of the original 7 days of creation, when in 6 days God made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested. Each Shabbat completes a full revolution of time, a time's original cycle, following which we start anew from Yom Rishon, the first day, as Sunday is called in Hebrew. So in Hebrew, the days of the week, as you know, are not named. The only one named biblically is Shabbat, Yom Shabbat, which is the seventh day. Friday also has a name, but it is a relatively, well, I was going to say recent. It existed 2,000 years ago in the first century, the preparation day. It's the day before Shabbat, so it's Friday. None of the other days have names. And in fact, even Friday is still referred to as the sixth day. So the days are the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day. We don't refer to them by names, as in Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Those are all of pagan or Gentile origin. And Gentile and pagan are not the same. They don't mean the same thing. They're not synonyms. But at any rate, this is why many Jewish life cycle observances are seven-day affairs. Two seven-day festivals frame our year. Passover, which runs from the 15th to the 21st of Nisan, which occurs in the first month of the year, and Sukkot, occurring exactly 6 months later, on Tishrei, the 15th to the 21st. That's the last Moedim. It's the last of the feasts of the Lord in the sixth month of the year, occurring 6 months later. A marriage is celebrated for a full week of Sheva Berachot, seven blessings. The death of a loved one, God forbid, is mourned for 7 days, which is referred to as Shiva, the days of Shiva. Our years, too, follow the cycle of creation. Six workday years are succeeded by a sabbatical year of Shemitah, which means suspension. In the land of Israel, all agricultural work is suspended on the seventh year, and the land's produce is declared free for the taking of all. Also suspended on the Shemitah year are all private debts and the terms of servitude of indentured servants. Finally, our sages describe the whole of human history as a seven millennial week, consisting of 6,000 years of human labor in developing God's world, and a seventh millennium that is holy Shabbat and rest for life everlasting, the era of Messiah, the coming of the Messiah. Right? So, this is a common way of looking at the way time works. So, we are in the year 5782. I expect, because of what Yeshua says about the days being shortened, if those days were not shortened, nobody would survive to make it to the millennium, to the seven to the seven thousandth year. But we are at the year 5782, so we have a couple of hundred plus days to go before the 6,000 year mark is reached. But this is the way the sages look at history based upon this this 7 day, 7 week, 7 yearly cycle. Okay? At any rate, with regard to matter and spirit, the cycle consists of two primary phases, and this is where the importance of the eighth comes in. Ordinary, chol, and holiness, kedushah. 6 days of labor are followed by a day of rest. 6 years of working the earth followed by a year of suspension and disinvolvement from the material. 6 millennia devoted to struggling with and developing the physical world, but a 7th millennium in which the sole occupation of the entire world will be the knowledge of God. The Torah's word for holy, kedushah, literally means removed and apart. It means to be separate, to be removed apart, to be removed essentially from the world system and set apart. If the number 7 defines the natural reality, then 8 represents that which is higher by nature, the spiritual reality or the heavenly reality. And that's why the number 1 is not used, because it wants to emphasize this heavenly or spiritual reality. So the covenant of circumcision, which binds the Jew to God in a bond that supersedes all nature and convention, even as it pervades every nook and cranny of life, is entered into on the 8th day of life, right? Not on the 1st day of the subsequent week of birth, but on the 8th day, right? So it ignores the convention. And again, it ignores the convention because it wants us to be attuned to the fact that circumcision is not just a physical act. It's a spiritual act, right? In other words, it isn't just the circumcision of the foreskin about which we should be preoccupied, but the circumcision of the heart as well, which is what circumcision is about, right? The festival of Shemini Atzeret, the 8th day of retention or assembly, whose function is to internalize the transcendent encompassing light of the Sukkah, occurs on the 8th day that follows Sukkot's 7 days, right? So Sukkot, if you are familiar with the way it is celebrated in the synagogue or in the Jewish community, Sukkot is a 7-day holiday followed by Shemini Atzeret, the 8th day of assembly, and Simchat Torah, which is essentially a 9th day of the holiday. But even the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which has 7 days, lasts 8 days because Passover, which is not a part of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, technically, is one of the days of that holiday too. So it's actually an 8-day festival. 7 Shemitah cycles are followed by a Jubilee year characterized by liberty, that is, freedom from all bounds, rather than just suspension. The sanctuary, whose role was to make the infinite reality of God an indwelling presence in the physical world, was inaugurated on the 8th day following a 7-day training period, and the millennium, or the messianic 7th millennium of history, will be followed by the ultimate 8th, the world to come, the Olam Haba, in which the divine reality will unite with the created reality in ways that we cannot even speculate upon in a world in which finite and infinite are mutually exclusive. But of course, it doesn't keep this issue from being discussed in the mystical literature, right? I mean, it's kind of the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes an interesting statement here that we cannot really even speculate or know what the Olam Haba is actually like, but of course it doesn't really stop people from talking about it. At any rate, in the words of the Talmud, all prophets prophesied only regarding the days of Moshiach, regarding the world to come. No eye can behold it. O God, save yours, right? Which is something, interestingly enough, that Yeshua says about God, right? Because God is a spirit, and transcends the universe, no one can know him except him, because he is a manifestation of God's presence in this world. So he has an intimate connection with God in a way that we don't. So he has an ability to reveal the character, the nature of God to us, the eternal words of the Torah to us, you know, in a way that transcends anybody else's ability to. The number 7 represents the cycle of creation. The number 8, this is an interesting way of expressing it, represents the circumference, right? The wholeness. That which lies beyond the perimeter of time and space. This is why the divine presence came to dwell in the Israelite camp on the 8th day. This is also alluded to in the saying of our sages in the tractate Erchin, that the lyre of the Messiah has 8 strings, right? So you can see that the number 8 is used in this rabbinic text regarding the Messiah in a mystical or a spiritual way to emphasize the spiritual or the heavenly character of the Messiah. Okay? At any rate, there is a good deal more which could be said about the number 8, but we need to move on, and you get the idea that 8 is a special number in Hebrew, and it speaks of the heavenly reality that is reflected in our earthly existence, but of course transcends that reality, right? It is different, it's distinct, and it's something which is supposed to, have an impact in our lives now. At any rate, let's move on. Vekafer ve'adcha uv'ad ha'am, this expression, atonement for yourself and for the people. We're going to spend a few minutes on this because it's an incredibly important aspect of the priestly responsibilities and obligations. Okay? Aaron was told that before offering atonement for the community, he must first obtain forgiveness for his own sins, according to the Ramban Nachmanides. Only after he himself was purified could he act for the people. We find the same rule in chapter 16 regarding the sacrificial service for Yom Kippur. The parallel between the inauguration service and that for Yom Kippur extends to other details as well, in particular to the complete burning of Aaron's chatat offering, his sin offering, no part being eaten by the kohanim, the priests. As with every new stage of life, the consecration of the sanctuary requires an act of general purification. Yom Kippur serves as the ultimate model for this concept. Thus, on his wedding day, the groom fasts and asks forgiveness for his sins, just as on Yom Kippur, right? Because a groom on his wedding day wants to enter the union that will be confirmed that day or finalized that day. He wants to enter that day pure and forgiven, right? He wants to enter that day in a way so as to enter a new reality, a new part of his life. But there are many implications of this this brief passage, and we're going to talk about a couple of them. The idea that the priest, the high priest, is required to make atonement for the community before he is allowed to make atonement for the community, he must first obtain forgiveness for his own sin. This is an issue which the author of Hebrews brings up in chapter 5. Every high priest is selected from among the people and is appointed to represent the people in matters related to God. By the way, it doesn't use the word mediator or intermediate, but that's what he is. In this passage, he's appointed to represent the people in matters related to God. So he stands in the gap between the people and God to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. Notice verse 2. He is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray, since he himself is subject to weakness. Now it's interesting, because most people take this passage as an attempt to express in what ways the priesthood of Aaron is significantly inferior to the priesthood of Messiah. Right? Have you ever heard that? The priesthood of Messiah is superior to that of Aaron. One of the reasons that is true is because the Aaronic priest has to offer a sacrifice for his own sin before he can offer a sin for the people, right? So, that is obviously not true in the case of the Messiah, because even though he is tempted like us in all things, he is without sin. So, that preliminary sacrifice isn't required on his part. He gets to offer himself up as a sacrifice without those aspects being applied to him. But the principles are applied to him, as we will see in a minute. The author of Hebrews regards this as a positive idea, right? Which we'll see more about in a minute. The high priest is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray. Why? Because he himself is subject to weakness, right? So it gives him the capacity or the ability to be empathic, to be sympathetic, to be connected to those he is serving. And this is an important idea. Because a leader who can't identify with those he leads, frankly, isn't much of a leader. And I'm not even sure that we would use that term for them. You know, we might use the word dictator instead, or another term, a demagogue. You know, a term that emphasizes the separation between them and the people he or she leads. But that was not to be true of the high priest, right? The high priest was supposed to identify with his people and to recognize that he is one of them, that he's connected to them in a very, very important way. This is why he had to offer sacrifices for his own sins as well as for the sins of the people. But this isn't a negative aspect of the high priest's ministry. This is regarded as a positive aspect of the high priest's ministry. And no one takes this honor on himself, but he receives it when called by God, just as Aaron was, right? So Aaron didn't appoint himself as the high priest. No high priest, well, not in biblical times, appointed themselves as high priest, right? They were appointed by God. In the same way, notice, Messiah did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest, right? So, the author of Hebrews makes a very important connection between the priesthood of Aaron and the priesthood of Messiah. In exactly the same way as God appointed the high priests in biblical times, he appointed the Messiah to be the high priest on behalf of his people as well. The only difference, of course, is that the order of his priesthood was different. The Messiah was not a high priest after the order of Aaron, but a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, about whom we know virtually nothing, as we have talked about before, right? I mean, you know, we know very little about Melchizedek, although what we do know is that he is used or mentioned in the Psalms, and particularly in some of the intertestamental period literature as a type of Messiah for a number of reasons, which we'll defer to another conversation. At any rate, regarding this idea, this concept, that the Messiah did not take upon himself the glory of becoming a high priest, but it was appointed to him, God said to him, "You are my son, today I have become your father," a quote from Psalm 2. And he says in another place, "You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek," a quote from Psalm 110. The high priest can be compassionate with the plight of those going astray because he himself is weak. How do we know? Because he must deal with his own sin before he can act on the behalf of others. Which, by the way, brings us back to the conversation that Ed directed before we started, right? This idea of forgiveness. This is something which should have an impact in our own lives too, right? In other words, because we need to be forgiven of sin, we should be less judgmental about the sins of others, right? So it's something which doesn't just apply to the high priest or to the Messiah. This concept or idea of weakness, we're all weak. As I have mentioned many times, right? We're like broken pots that God has to keep glued together in order for us to function in the way that we're supposed to. But, you know, make no mistake about it, we are all broken in one way or another. At any rate, this passage from Leviticus 16 is the passage which speaks about the high priest making the offering on his own behalf. Okay, from the tractate on Yom Kippur in the Talmud, the high priest comes to his bullock, which is already standing between the outer hall, leading into the temple's interior and the altar, its body north to south and its face turned to the west. The high priest is back to the east, his face to the west, stands by the bullock. He presses both hands between its horns and makes confession, saying, "I beseech you, O Lord, I have committed iniquity. I have transgressed. I have sinned before you. I and my house, I beseech you, O Lord, cleanse the iniquities, the transgressions, the sins that I have committed, transgressed, and sinned before you. I and my house. For in the Torah of Moses, your servant, it is written, 'On this day shall atonement be made for you to cleanse you from all of your sins so that you shall be clean before the Lord.'" Right? It goes on to say a few other things. But notice, as we move through this section, it goes on to speak about the fact that Aaron raises his hands after this has taken place, and he blesses the people. So there is great significance to this idea of blessing the people. We're going to talk about this a little bit more in a minute. I want to just say something about the blessing here that comes in verse 22. But we're going to continue this discussion regarding the humility that's required of the high priest, and by type, the humility that is characteristic of the Messiah as well. in a minute when we talk about the steps that the high priest takes. After the sacrifice is offered, he steps down from the altar and puts himself back on the same level as the people. But before he does, Aaron lifts his hands towards the people and blesses them. And having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the fellowship offering, he steps down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting, where they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down. V'asa Aharon et yadav. Aaron raised his hands. We find in the Mishnah, in the tractate on the daily offerings, and also in the Michilta, a midrash, that this blessing took place before the offering was burned on the altar. Interestingly, Rambam, Maimonides, has it that the blessing was given afterwards. In any case, it is clear that the blessing was a direct consequence of the sacrificial service and the benefits provided by the blessings. A blessing are seen in the fruits of that service. In the same way, we find that Hashem gave his blessing to mankind after Noah's sacrifice and gave his blessings to Abraham after Abraham's descendants after the sacrificial binding of Isaac. Sacrifice willingly offered by man is the source of the blessings he receives. Blessings are transmitted through the hands. The word yadav, his hands, is written here in the singular form. Yadav means his hand. It should say yadayiv, which is the plural, but it doesn't, which is another clue that there is something important about the text, about his hands, which are plural, not singular, even though they're referred to in the singular. At any rate, it is written in the singular form without the second yod, but read as plural. We find another example of this peculiar form in Jacob's blessings of his grandsons, for which he apparently wanted to concentrate the powers of blessing in his right hand. That hand represents triumph. Your right hand, Hashem, is glorious in power. The passage is in Genesis 48, where Joseph brings his sons to Jacob, right? Ephraim and Manasseh, and we always say Ephraim and Manasseh. We should be saying Manasseh and Ephraim, because Manasseh is the oldest, right? But we don't, because when Jacob blessed the boys, he crossed his hands. He put his right hand on the head of Ephraim, his left hand on the head of Manasseh, and he blessed them, and he made Ephraim preeminent, right? He essentially makes the younger brother, he puts him in a position above the older brother, something which is unusual, not unheard of in the Bible. That was true of Jacob and Esau as well. But it's interesting because Rashi there teaches us that when Israel does the will of God, the left hand, the instrument of punishment, blends with the right, the instrument for mercy. Right? So it's interesting because in the rabbinic literature, the left hand is associated with punishment, the right hand with mercy. Right? But of course, if you look at the scripture and at the various passages in which the right hand is mentioned, the right hand is always associated with power, with strength, with the role of Messiah in the millennial kingdom, for example. At any rate, thus symbolically speaking, the two hands together become one. The idea of the domination of the left hand symbolizing din, justice, by the right hand symbolizing chesed. Mercy is often the way it's translated. Loving kindness might be better, but is discussed further in his commentary to Exodus 15. But the same idea is expressed, is expressly practiced when the Kohanim partially places the right hand over the left as they pronounce the Birkat Kohanim, the blessing of the Kohanim. I don't know if you've ever been to a synagogue service where where the priest, a priest blesses the community. Like, for example, during the additional service of Yom Kippur, there is a time during the service when the Kohanim, the priests, are called forward. The Leviim are also called forward. They wash the hands of the priests before the blessing. And then there is a time during the service when the priests bless the community. But when they put their hands together to bless the community, they don't do so like this. They do so like this. They put the right hand slightly over the left as they recite the blessing, and that represents God's justice and mercy being connected together in our lives in such a way that reflects His care and His compassion and His love for us, yet retains His character or integrity as a God of justice. At any rate, there are many passages which speak to this regarding the right hand, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies my footstool, several passages, okay? You can look at them on your own. I'd like to jump back down to this passage regarding what the priest does after he offers the sacrifice. From having performed the sin offering, the elevation offering, and the peace offering, he steps down from the altar. In the figurative sense, the Kohen who gives his blessing must come down from his heights and know the state of mind of those whom he wants to bless. The one who wants to atone for his sins, chatat, sin offering, the one seeking to come close to God, olah, elevation offering, and the one desiring to express his gratitude, shlamim, the peace offering. Now the idea is an incredibly important one. Okay? The Kohen who gives this blessing, who sacrifices first for himself, right, and then on behalf of the people, and then steps down from the elevated position he is in at the altar and steps back down to the level of the community, is communicated in these words. After the Kohen who gives his blessing must come down from his heights and know the state of mind of those whom he wants to bless. And this is exactly what the Messiah has done. So the author of Hebrews and other apostolic authors, they capitalize on this concept, on this idea, and apply it to the Messiah, right? The Messiah, as it were, stepped down from his heights, right, in heaven. And he was found in fashion as a man, like in this passage in Philippians. In your relations with one another, have the same mindset as the Messiah Yeshua, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, notice, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Notice Paul is very careful with his words, being made in human likeness. He looked human, but he was a manifestation of God's presence among us. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Right? So it's difficult not to imagine that Paul too, like the author of Hebrews, isn't perhaps thinking about the role that the high priest plays in the service he renders at the sanctuary, right? Because he's the one, too, who stands in the gap between God and the people. The high priest, the Aaronic high priest, of course, has to offer a sacrifice for himself, first and then for the people, right? But it is something which is supposed to help him come to terms with his humanity, his weakness, his humility, right? His position in the community. He is, in fact, an intermediary, but he's no better than anyone else. He's no different than anyone else. He's in the position he's in, not because he aspired to it, but because God appointed him to it, right? And that's also true of the Messiah, that he takes upon himself the nature of a human being, right? In appearance, he is like a man, right? But he is actually a manifestation of God in flesh and blood form. The author of Hebrews goes farther. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in the humanity, right? Since we have flesh and blood, in order for the Messiah to facilitate his mission, he must share in our humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Right? So, this is an important reason, which we've discussed before, why the Messiah had to be manifest in a body of flesh and blood. Why he had to be made in human likeness, right? Why he had to come as an individual, as a man on behalf of all mankind. Because he had to be related to us. He had to be connected to us. He had to die in this reality, in this world. He freed those of us whose whole lives have been held in slavery because of their fear of death to Satan. For surely it is not angels he helps, but who? Abraham's descendants. Interesting expression. Who are Abraham's descendants? The people of Israel. Are the Gentiles Abraham's descendants? I mean, I suppose you could say that some are, by virtue of being connected to Ishmael, right? But Abraham's descendants is a euphemism for the Jewish people, the people of Israel. And of course, the Gentiles are included because they are connected. They're grafted in among Abraham's descendants into the olive tree, right? Because they trust Yeshua as the Messiah. But it goes on to say, for this reason he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people, because he himself suffered when he was tempted. So he suffered like we do, and because he suffered like we do, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Now this concept, this idea is taken right from Leviticus chapter 9. Taken right from the words that describe things that the high priest does in association with the offering of the sacrifices he offers. First on his own behalf, then on behalf of the people, and the steps that he takes when he descends down from the altar to the level of the people once again, once that sacrifice has been offered, right? And this is what the Messiah, this is how the life of the Messiah is characterized too. So the fact that the high priest offers a sacrifice for himself and then for the people is regarded as a positive attribute by the author of Hebrews, not a negative attribute. And in Hebrews chapter 4, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Yeshua the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. Right? The people of Israel had a high priest who could empathize with their weaknesses. Why? Because he was one of them. How do we know? Because, as it's been said, he had to offer a sacrifice for himself before he could offer a sacrifice for the people. And because after the sacrifice was offered, he took steps down from the altar to once again be on the same level as the people he served, right? This is what the Messiah does too. We also have a great high priest who has, who has ascended to heaven, right? But the fact is, he descended from heaven and he ascended back to heaven. It is Yeshua, the Son of God. Let us hold firmly to the faith. We do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted like us in every way. He has suffered like us in every way. He has been tempted like us in every way. Therefore, he can empathize with our weakness, right? Except in his case, he did not sin. So, he doesn't offer a sacrifice for himself. He skips that part and offers a sacrifice for us. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. I mean, these are incredibly comforting words for me. I hope for you as well. The idea that we can find mercy and grace to help us in our time of need, regardless of what our needs are, right? Regardless of what our needs are, regardless of what we're going through, regardless of whatever difficulties we have faced or suffered, or whatever difficulties we are currently struggling with or have struggled with in the past and don't fully appreciate or understand, right? The Lord is able to help us. We can find mercy with him and grace to help us through these things. Why? Right? Because we have a high priest who experienced these things like us, and he is able to intercede on our behalf. Right? He is an intermediary between us and God and is able to extend the support we need when we need it. This is something which is incredibly important as far as I'm concerned. This final section, you might have to read most of this on your own. This speaks about the death of Nadav and Abihu. They took their censers, put fire in them, added incense, and it says they offered unauthorized fire. This expression, unauthorized, is strange fire, avodah zarah, before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will be proved holy, and in the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" But Aaron remains silent. So Moses summoned Misael and Lizaphan, the sons of Aaron's uncle, Uziel, and said to them, "Come here, carry your cousins outside the camp away from the front of the sanctuary." So they were carried out of the temple precinct, outside of the temple area. And Moses instructs Aaron to continue with his service to the Lord, that he would not be afforded the opportunity to mourn for his sons at that time. There is, of course, a great deal of discussion about this because the strange fire is not explained, right? There is no explanation, not an easy one to discern in the scriptures, although there is much said about this. There is a passage in Leviticus Rabbah in the Midrash on this section that does address the question regarding what happened. There are four items mentioned. They were slain for drawing near to the holy place because they went into the most innermost section of the sanctuary when they were not authorized to, into the holy of holies when they were not authorized to. They were slain for offering because they brought an offering that they were not enjoined or expected or required to bring. In other words, they took it upon themselves to take an offering to the Lord that wasn't asked for. For the strange fire, they brought coals inside the sanctuary from which came from an oven and not from the sacrificial altar. The coals that were taken into the holy place were supposed to be taken from the altar, not from an oven nearby. And for not having taken counsel from each other, they did not discuss the rightness of what they were doing with each other. They assumed inappropriately that their offering would be accepted. And unfortunately, neither questioned the other about the rightness of what they were or were not doing. So it speaks of a lack of humility on their part. And something else that is important has to do with the fact that Moses gives an instruction immediately after this event that the priests are not to drink wine or fermented drink prior to their service. In other words, a priest cannot be inebriated during his time on duty. Right? They are not allowed to drink in a way that would affect their judgment. So it has been suggested by some that this was in fact the problem with Nadav and Abihu, that they were drinking and did something under the influence of alcohol that they would not have done otherwise. And that of course is a possibility, but according to the rabbinic literature, their cause of death was their act of unwarranted trespass, of non-commanded entry and offering, right? And of course, one last point. This brings up the whole issue of alcohol and strong drink. Nowhere in the Bible is the drinking of alcohol or strong drink prohibited. And wine, of course, is wine. Strong drink is a fermented beverage. And nothing in the Bible prohibits us from drinking it. And in fact, we are told to drink it on some occasions. We drink wine at Passover, for example. Paul told Timothy to drink wine for the sake of his stomach on one occasion, right? Because it has a beneficial effect on the stomach in ways that water does not. And frankly, wine can't be contaminated in the same way that water can. But the point is that there are many passages which address this issue. The one thing that is addressed is the idea of drunkenness, right? Drunkenness in the scriptures would be the tendency to overdrink and to get drunk. And that, of course, is a problem. So essentially, in effect, bring up the whole issue of drinking, over drinking, drinking to excess, in a way that an individual is frequently drunk, habitually drunk, whatever terms that you want to apply to it. That is something which the scriptures do, prohibit and caution against. So that is an issue, but the drinking of a fermented beverage is not, right? So some of us have an ability to distinguish between those and others. Others do not. Right. So, depending upon what you know, how that plays out in your own life, that kind of speaks to whatever issues are required to deal with it. Okay. So, I apologize for not having a little more opportunity to talk about Nadav and Avihu, but we've reached our time, so I'm going to stop here and ask if there are any questions or comments about what we've discussed. Anyone? Tina, go ahead.
Shabbat Shalom. I just want to comment in the beginning when you were talking about how the days of the week are not named. It's that's very similar in Chinese.
Oh, cool.
The days of the week, when we say them, it's not a name. We say same thing, like day one, day two, day three.
Good.
Like it's lai bai yat, lai bai yi, lai bai sam. So I found that really interesting.
That is interesting.
And that, at least in the Chinese culture, the number 8 is also, it's a very lucky number. And so, I just, you know, the correlation is very interesting. And I mean, I know, like, in Hebrew, you read from right to left, right? Same thing in Chinese, you read from right to left.
Yeah.
There's a lot of similarities there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Nations that are east of Israel read from right to left. Nations that are west of Israel read from left to right. Interesting phenomena. I mean, generally speaking, it's an interesting phenomena. And you know, I mean, you know that that Sunday, the name Sunday, comes from the worship of the sun god. The name Monday comes from the worship of the moon god. Saturday comes from Saturn. Thursday comes from Thor, right? All the names of the Gregorian week come from the names of the gods that the people worshipped in the Roman and Greek world, right? So, yeah, so that's... So the Chinese were obviously not influenced by Greek and Roman mythology.
No, but they do have their own set of gods.
Oh,
yeah.
There
is a difference there. So.
Yeah.
And that they believe in the whole like reincarnation and what you do in life, in this life affects your next life, or what you did in your past life affects this current life. So there's that
right.
Vicious circle, I guess.
Well, you know, all cultures, in this is an opinion, but in my opinion, all cultures have to somehow deal with the existence of evil in this world. And karma is the way that Eastern religions deal with it. They tend to explain evil in this world on the basis of karma and the way karma works, right? In Western cultures, it is dealt with differently, that evil exists as a part of this world system, and it will be judged at the judgment. So, I mean, the extent to which it affects us in the here and now is something which is common to all cultures. Right? Good. Okay. Thank you, Tina. Interesting observation.
Very... The random fire trucks yelling. James is in the fire trucks.
What's that?
I don't know if you heard in the background.
Oh, I did a little.
Yelling fire trucks.
Yeah. Yeah, no problem. Very good, thank you. Anybody else before we go? Anyone?
Baba, I had a question.
Yeah.
Is the reason that Moses' sons weren't in the priesthood because they weren't Jewish? Because his wife, Zipporah, wasn't Jewish.
Zipporah wasn't Jewish. That's a good question. The hard part has to do with when we talk about Jewish identity today, for example, we say that someone who is Jewish is from a Jewish mother. If your mother was Jewish, you're Jewish, in the exact way that you expressed it, right? The problem is that was, I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to attach that definition to biblical times, right? I mean, like, for example, there are several non-Jewish women in the genealogy of Yeshua, but he's considered Jewish, right? I mean, at four points in Yeshua's past, his ancestors, by that definition, would not have been considered Jewish, right? But they were. They were regarded as Jewish. So, what is sometimes said is that, well, you know, they converted to Judaism. They became identified with the tribe of Judah. And, you know, but it's an explanation. It makes sense and is undoubtedly true in one way or another, but there's no record of a conversion in the biblical text, right? The closest we get to it are the words of Ruth. Your God will be my God, your people will be my people. You know, Ruth made a commitment to go with Naomi, and they would, and nothing but death would ever separate them, right? That's as close as we get to a conversion process of any of the women connected to the genealogy of Yeshua. But they're all considered Jewish. Yeshua is considered Jewish. He's from the line of David, right? I mean, so, with regard to Moses' wife, she was not Jewish, but, you know, when she marries Moses, she is connected to the people of Israel. We don't know why he left her at home or sent her home for part of the Exodus process. Perhaps he wanted to keep her safe. Maybe he knew that she would be, you know, that it would, that maybe he knew that he had so much on his plate, for example, that he didn't want her and his children neglected. Right? I mean, we could speculate a great deal about the reasons why he sent her home. But, you know, when she rejoins the people in the wilderness and brings her sons with her, and, you know, it is observed that they are not yet circumcised, who circumcises them? She does, even though it's the father's responsibility, right? In other words, if you go to a circumcision today, right? I mean, a typical circumcision, what happens is that the father takes the instrument that the moel, the rabbi who does the service, who does the circumcision, does the bris, the father hands the moel, the instrument that will be used for the procedure. Why? Because it's his responsibility to do it. Since he can't, he assigns a representative, but he hands him the instrument to do it with, right? It's just one of the things that was done. That's That's what my son did when he handed, when the Moyle came over to circumcise his kids, his boys, right? I mean, that's what you do. And, but in the Bible, Moses' wife circumcises them, right? So she's connected in some way, so we don't really know why. What we do know what we know from the rabbinic literature is that God intended Moses to be the high priest, but the text doesn't say that. He forfeits that privilege because of his reluctance to embrace his mission. And when the Lord raises up Aaron to speak on his behalf and to go with him, Aaron becomes the one who is eventually vested with that role. So Aaron becomes the high priest, and his descendants are the ones who become high priest in his place, right? And frankly, we don't hear anything else about the children of Moses, his two boys, right? I mean, nothing else that I can think of off the top of my head, nothing else, well, certainly nothing significant is ever said about them again, right? I mean, sometimes children walk in the footsteps of their parents, and sometimes they don't, right? And so, in this case, they don't. And of course, the rabbis would say that the priesthood is obtained through heredity, but scholarship in Torah is not. Right? In other words, just because your father's a great rabbi doesn't mean you'll become a great rabbi. Right? And just because your father may have been a salesman like mine, right, then it doesn't mean that you can't become a Torah scholar. Right? That's the idea. That scholarship is something that can be obtained by anyone, like it was in the case of Moses, and the priesthood is something that's obtained through heredity, like it was and is in the case of the priests. Right, so, right, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from all of this. But, unfortunately, the speculation notwithstanding, we really don't know why. Yeah. Sorry. Any other questions I can't answer before we go? Anyone?
Don't forget to look in the chat, sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Okay. From Rivka, great study, the saying of without justice there is no mercy, and without mercy there is no justice. That's a great saying. I don't know who said it. I've heard it many times. Thank you. It's a great saying. From Bud, Wednesday is Odin, Tuesday is Tyre. Another reference, thank you, Bud. Reference to the names of the Gregorian weekdays being associated with pagan gods. From Rivka, there is that thing about circumcising the boys on the way into Egypt. Moses' wife didn't seem too keen about it. What's interesting is that the descendants, the children, the male descendants of those who left Egypt were not circumcised in the wilderness. You know, that's part of the irony of this story with regard to Moses' wife, Zipporah, and the whole account of God being angry because Moses' sons were not circumcised. Because what's the first thing the Jewish people do when they cross the Jordan and enter into the promised land? The males are circumcised. They're all adults at this point, right? I mean, they cross into enemy territory a few miles away from Jericho or from Ai, the first towns on their list of targets, right? And all the males, adults, are circumcised. And they're, you know, they're what's it called? They're incapacitated, right? They're incapacitated for a little while they're preparing to go to battle. I mean, right there, there's just... And why is God so upset with Moses when none of the children are circumcised? Right? I mean, there's many things about the story that are peculiar. So, unfortunately, I say this frequently, the Torah only includes information that's important for telling the story or making whatever point it's trying to. Right? So, that's the hard part, is discerning the lesson sometimes when there is a lack of detail. Right? At any rate, that's the way it works. But thank you, Rivka. Good observation. From Ed, great lesson. Thank you. The explanation of the importance of the eighth was new for me. Yes, it's the eighth is an interesting phenomenon, which, of course, connects us to the Olam Haba. From Elaine, I've always heard that eight is the number of new beginnings. And yes, I think it can be associated with the idea of new beginnings. The Olam Haba is a new beginning for us in many ways. We won't be in a body of flesh and blood. We'll be in a spiritual body, that is not subject to decay and corruption or sin. So that will be a new beginning for us. Circumcision certainly represents a new beginning in the life of a child, in many ways. So I think it is correct to say that the number eight can be associated with new beginnings too, right? But it certainly is connected to the spiritual component of the way our lives work. So, very good. Thank you, Elaine, for that comment. Ed, Rivka, Charlene, Tina, anybody else before we go? Bud, thank you. Yes.
I was just wondering if when we were talking about the lineage, you know, the mother being the... Well, wasn't it that Ephraim and Manasseh had an Egyptian mother, and I don't even know if they were circumcised, and then they were adopted by Israel?
Yeah, that's another example. Thanks, bud. That's another example. Ephraim and Manasseh, Asenath, is Egyptian, right? But in the intertestamental period literature... there is one of the books of the pseudepigrapha is called Joseph and Asenath. I don't know if you remember, those of you who attend Thursday night, the Thursday study. We talked about the book Joseph and Asenath. And in that particular book, it describes Asenath's conversion. Right. So now there is a work, a pseudepigrapha, but it's intertestamental, but whereas the closest expression of conversion on the part of any of Yeshua's non-Jewish mothers, ancestors, comes is Ruth's confession, in Joseph and Asenath, in the intertestamental period book, it specifically says that Asenath converts to Judaism, right? She comes to trust in the God of Israel. It says she turns away from false gods and she converts. So it describes a conversion process. I mean, it's not identical to the process that's employed today, but it's very similar to it, right? So, so she is regarded as Jewish, and so her children are regarded as Jewish as well. But that's another example, right? Ephraim and Manasseh. I mean, when a man blesses his children on Friday night, blesses his sons, he says, "May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh," right? Not Reuben and Judah, Ephraim and Manasseh. I mean, it's interesting. And of course, I think it's safe to say that Joseph and Asenath raised their children as Israel, as people of Israel. Their names are Hebrew names, and their upbringing would have been consistent with the way Jews raise their children as Jews. So, even those married to non-Jewish spouses, that is often the case, right? So, very good. Hope. By the way, the Jewish mother thing. Just one last thing, quickly. Associating a Jewish child with their Jewish mother comes from times of conflict in Jewish history. Most recently, with the revolts against Rome, there were so many men who died in the various revolts against Rome that in order to protect a child, if a child was with a Jewish mother, the rabbis ruled that the child was to be regarded as Jewish, right? So it was their way of protecting the child. It was not their way of discriminating against the Jewishness of a man as over against that of a woman. It was a way of protecting a child and assuring that they were connected to the community in such a way that they wouldn't be considered an outsider, right? So, at some point it became irrelevant whether or not the husband was Jewish. If the mother was Jewish, the child was Jewish, and that was enough. Right, so that rule became a minchag, a rule that has existed for a very long time and has essentially come to reflect legal precedence, right? Even though it's technically not halakha, it's a minchag, a tradition, a long-standing tradition. So that's where it comes from. Did Abraham circumcise Isaac? Yes, he did. When Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised Isaac. Yep, that's correct. But again, the text doesn't tell us how Abraham knew to circumcise his son, except that he himself was circumcised. He and Ishmael were circumcised, earlier. But where did the skill come from? We have no idea, right? What did he practice on? We don't know. But I would think that's not the kind of procedure you would want to do without any knowledge regarding how it works, right?
Rabbi, it doesn't say who circumcised Abraham, right?
Well, the text says that he circumcised himself.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, me too. That's what I think of it as well. Except I would probably express it more strongly. Oh, dang is a good way of putting it.
When I first read about Moses' wife, when the angel was going to kill him, and she circumcised the kids to stop him from being killed. I always thought it was because he was in a covenant relationship with the Lord.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is sometimes said, that, I mean, here Moses is the one who is leading God's people out of Egypt. The people, you know, the circumcision is a sign of the covenant between God and his people, and Moses' own sons are not circumcised. So it was a very big deal, right? But that is sometimes what is said, but it's not what the text says. The text doesn't provide us an explanation. So that speculation may be true, or it may in part be true. But, you know, it's not possible to say for sure that's the reason, because the text doesn't say. And I can't think of another text that even refers to it. Right? And as I mentioned, the whole generation that leaves Egypt is not circumcised. They have to be, now I'm sure some were, but you know, the men who, the children who fled Egypt and who grow up in the wilderness and enter the promised land, they get circumcised in the promised land. And that whole event provokes questions too. Like, why weren't they circumcised on the eighth day in the wilderness?
Right. I have another question, yeah. Rabbi, or maybe not a question, but I think those scriptures that prohibit drunkenness, I always felt like that was a guideline for people that had an issue with drinking. That if they drank in excess where they were drunken, that this was, you know, a guideline to say, you know, this is what would happen or whatever. Because if you know you have a problem, you know, like being an alcoholic, then you know you shouldn't drink. But 'cause we were always, I always heard in church that drinking was prohibited, but I would always say, well, you know, Jesus turned, one of his first miracles is that he turned water into wine, so it must not, you know, must not be too bad. And also, I found the other scriptures where, you know, Paul said a little wine is good for stomach or whatever ails you or whatever, so it's not bad, or it's not considered a sin to drink wine. But I think that if you are an alcoholic and you cannot control yourself, or it makes you angrier, or cause you to have a personality problems or character or whatever, I think those were just guidelines to go by.
Yeah, there's certainly, I don't think that's true, I would say, that you know, I think drunkenness generally is a... is an inappropriate state or condition for us to be in, you know, it's difficult. It's very difficult when many people, drunkenness is the result of just overindulging. But in some cases, you know, in the lives of some people, it's something which people have very little control over, right? I don't say that to justify it in any way. It's just that alcohol affects different people differently. But Bud made a comment here, which applies to this conversation. As an alcoholic, it came to a point that I found that I was trying to serve two masters, which we can't, which is a good way of expressing it. Because for some, alcohol does exert a mastery influence over them. right? And it's an issue. I personally, you know, can't think of any reason that I would want to or aspire to be in a drunken state to deal with, right? I mean, I have been drunk a couple of times in the past, but I hate the way it feels, right? So, I mean, it was, you know, I don't know how many years ago when I was young, right? But I just don't like the way it feels, and so, you know, don't drink to a point where I feel that way. That's the bottom line. But that's just not the way it is for others, and I have issues with other things, right? So that's the hard part, is everybody struggles with something, and that happens to be one that that gets a lot of press, but it's an issue, it's a problem, it can be. So you're right, though. I mean, the scripture, obviously, I mean, the prohibition is designed to, you know, preserve the welfare of the community generally and of the individual specifically, right? It's just, it's not a good place to be.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, thank you. Difficult subject to talk about. Anybody else before we go? By the way, in your notes are various passages. There are several passages that speak of being drunken, drunkenness, and in one of the passages is the instruction when an individual made their pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Right, and they took the tithe, the third tithe, which is used for the pilgrimage to Jerusalem. When they celebrate the holidays, they're allowed to purchase wine or fermented drink or other strong drink. Right, they're allowed to drink a fermented beverage when they attend the festival celebrations. Right. Stopping short of becoming drunken, of drunkenness, but it's one of the things that was permitted. It's not just wine. It would apply to, to Irish whiskey, for example. It would apply to anything. It's okay to drink Irish whiskey, right? But in moderation, not as a daily beverage. So there's different ways of looking at it. Elaine referred to Yeshua's first miracle, which was changing the water into wine. And of course it was wine, not false wine. And Paul's exhortation to Timothy, right? To drink a little wine. So the whole issue of alcohol has become very difficult to talk about, primarily because much of what is said has nothing to do with what the Bible actually teaches about it, right? But about cultural issues when it comes to alcohol, not what the texts say, at any rate. Good, thank you, Elaine. Anybody else before we go? Anyone? Okay. Well, if there is nothing else to add, Then I will say Shabbat Shalom. May the Lord be with you. There's the boy.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, James. Very good. Okay. Shabbat Shalom, all. May the Lord be with you and bless you with a wonderful week this week. God bless you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thanks for sharing your Shabbat with us. It's great to see everybody. Look forward to seeing you this week. May the Lord be with you.
Yes.
Bye for now. Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye. Recording stuff.